Okay, good morning, everybody. The subject I've chosen for today's shiur is most definitely Mein Yonah Dioma. It is on Sefer Yonah, which we say as a Haftorah for Yom Kippur. You all know the story in Sefer Yonah, and all of our classical Mefarshim pretty much assume that the story of Yonah actually took place as described in the Navi, that it's not an allegory for something else, but it actually took place. However, most Mefarshim also assume that the story in Sefer Yonah has significance beyond itself, and so it's a kind of a mashal as well as being literally true, a mashal for some deeper truths about Avodas Hashem and the escape from thereof. But what we're going to learn today is not what it says in Sefer Yonah, but what one medrash has to say about what went on in the story of Yonah. There are actually three versions of this medrash. There is one in the Yalkut Shimoni, which we're going to learn. There is one in Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer, and there is another in Medrash Tanhuma. They are very similar, especially the Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer and Yalkut Shimoni versions. Although the Yalkut Shimoni has one important facet that is lacking in Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer, so that's why I chose Yalkut Shimoni. But they all relate the story in a far more dramatic way, I guess, than Sefer Yonah, which is pretty dramatic, and fill in many, many details, so to speak, in a way that I think you'd have to characterize as fantastical. You know, there's an extended conversation between Yonah and one fish and another fish, and Yonah confronts the Leviathan. It's a very dramatic story. And I guess some people could take it literally, but that's sort of not the way I read it. I think it's designed to teach us a lesson, to teach us some deep truths about Avodas Hashem, and we'll tackle it. So it's a very long medrash. We can't do all of it. We don't have the time to do all of it. So what I've done is I've bracketed out parts that I'm going to skip. As it is, it's going to be hard to finish. So I may try to move along a little more quickly and take fewer questions than I usually do, because it's just a lot of material and you need to get to Morning Seder. Backdrop to the Medrash, or the backdrop to the part we're going to learn, is Yonah is, as you know, commanded to deliver a nevuah to Nineveh, urging them to do tshuva. Background is that Hashem had sent him beforehand to Bnei Yisrael to do tshuva, and then punishment was averted. Same thing happened a second time. Punishment was averted. Yonah says, now Jews don't think I'm a they think I'm a Navi Sheker. I keep on prophesying doom, and then they're always saved. So what kind of a Navi am I? So my reputation amongst Bnei Yisrael is besmirched. He's afraid if he delivers the Nevuah to Nineveh that his reputation amongst the Umos Olam will be likewise besmirched. He's also afraid that since they're Krovei Tshuva, it will cast aspersions on Bnei Yisrael. So he resists and does not want to follow Hashem's command to deliver the Nevuah. So we'll start where the arrow goes down. You see the little arrow that goes down? That summarizes what I just said. Dan Yonah beino levein asmo, v'yomar yodea ani shagayim krovei tshuvahem v'yasu tshuva. I know that the goyim are krovei tshuva, so they'll do tshuva. Umoshlo rogzi al Yisrael, and anger will rule over Bnei Yisrael. V'lo daishi Yisrael koronosi navi sheker, laf ovde alilim koronosi navi sheker. So from Yonah's perspective, the obligation to deliver this nevuah was irrational. It was both imprudent and irrational. It was imprudent because it was harmful to himself and to Bnei Yisrael, and therefore irrational because why should he hurt Bnei Yisrael? Yes?
Is he concerned for his own honor, or is he concerned for Hashem's kavod? Meaning, if people don't trust the Navi, they have no connection.
It's a good question. It doesn't say. Both good readings. Doesn't really say. But in any case, these are kind of things. This is sort of well-known, these kind of points. But what happens next is, the way the Navi puts it is, the Medrash puts it is quite interesting. Evrach l'makom she'ein kvodo shom. I will escape to the place where Hashem's honor cannot be found. His kavod cannot be found. Now that's a puzzling expression. What does it mean that Hashem's kavod cannot be found? First of all, Hashem is malei kol ha'olam. Hashem is everywhere. Why is Hashem less on the sea than he is in Kew Gardens Hills? I mean, Hashem is everywhere. So what does it mean, makom she'ein kvodo shom? So I think that the word kavod is etymologically related to the word kaved, which means heavy. And what I think Yonah is saying, and this flows into the whole rest of the Medrash, is that Hashem's presence in the world is a grave weight upon his shoulders. He can't handle all of the obligations, the commands that to him make no sense, like the command to go to Nineveh and to give them Musar so they'll do tshuva. It makes no sense to him. He can't handle those obligations. So he wants to escape to a place where Hashem's obligations upon him will not be felt so heavily, so weightily. If you've ever been, anybody here ever kayak or canoe in the sea? Yes, it's a great experience. A little bit hazardous, I'd say. I've done it myself. You know, you're in this little kayak and there's this huge boats going by and these monster waves, and you know, you feel like you're leaving to a different world, a world in which you float, which is the antithesis of gravity. In other words, instead of this pressure of Hashem's obligations, you're in a barren universe. Go past the boats, you know, if you've had this experience, you kayak way into the sea, you know, you're completely alone. You're just waves and water and yourself in your kayak, or your partner in your kayak, and maybe an island way off to the distance. I do this every summer during my summer vacation to Maine, so like it's something I actually feel. This idea of evrach, you're kind of leaving the kavo, the weight that Hashem places upon us. And I would say that in the Medrash's vision, as we'll see, as the whole Sipur unfolds, this is Yonah's agenda. He feels the need to escape the pressure of mitzvos that he can't understand. And we'll see the way in which his escape unfolds, but I think that's what is happening here. So we'll skip a little. You should take these with you, and if you have a chance, read the whole thing. This is just a slightly abridged version. Do most of it, but not all of it. Anyway, so going to the end of the bracket, Yarad liYafo, he went down to Yafo, v'lo matza aniya leirad sham, and he couldn't find a boat. V'haisa aniya miYafo mahalach shnei yamim, but he heard that there was a boat 2 days' travel from the port of Yafo. You know, Yafo is a port. V'ra Yonah. Excuse me. Ma asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu? What did HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? Hevi alea ruach sara ve'erzira liYafo. He brought a powerful wind which drove the boat back to Yafo, back to the port. Ra Yonah v'samach simcha gedola. And Yonah saw and he rejoiced with a great joy. Amar achshav ani yodea shadarki musheres lefanai. Now I know that Hashem, my way is made right before me, and it's obviously I've taken the right choice because this whole miraculous storm comes and brings the boat back. So I think it's fair to ask, what's Hashem's agenda? Like here, Yonah is escaping from him. You might think Hashem might put up obstacles, you know, like Avram on the way to the Akedah. The Satan comes and blocks him in all kinds of different ways. Hashem takes the inverse approach to the Satan, maybe not surprisingly, but here it seems to be the opposite. He makes it easier for him to escape. Now, why would Hashem do that?
Yeah.
What? Excellent. Excellent. B'derek sh'adam rotza leilech molichin oso. I think this is an example of that. And there's a very deep insight into that teaching, which is, think of Hashem as a master educator, master teacher. So what a master teacher wants his students to do is learn what he wants to teach him. And sometimes the most effective way to teach your student is to allow them to make mistakes and to suffer the consequences of those mistakes so that they never do them again. You know, if a teacher just tells, or a parent just tells the child, here, do this and don't do that, either they listen, they don't listen. But if a child, parent gives a child a little leeway, and they make, and the parent knows that by making a certain choice can be harmful to the child. Like, you know, instead of the parent making sure the kid does his homework, like hammering him over the head, he leaves it up to the kid. You know, you can read your book or you can do homework. You don't do your homework, what happens? You get punished in school and you lose your recess and you lose all of your nosh. Well, the kid presumably will learn, having made that mistaken choice, with the freedom to make that choice, not to make that choice again. So Hashem wants to make it possible for Yonah to learn the consequences of his choices that flow out of his freedom. And this is in many ways about Yonah finding his freedom, escaping from a life of kavod, a life of weight, a life of obligations that make no sense, to finding freedom. And Hashem wants to enable him to see the consequences of freedom in the choices that you make. That's point number one. Another point I'd make about this is that I think the Medrash wants to convey to us that sometimes happiness is illusory, and that we think we're in a great place, and then it turns out to be in a horrible place. And that we can't ever accept what our life situation is at face value. Yonah was sameach simcha gedola. This is great, right? Of course, Hashem is planning a whole trap for him. And what he thought was really great, darki miyusheres lefana ash, this is a hashgacha pratis, right? That's what he thought. It turns out that what appears to be good is sometimes illusory. And in fact, it's something for us to learn in our own lives. You know, you get your A, you get into the graduate school you want to get into, it may be the worst possible thing for you. Maybe you never should have gone to the graduate school. Maybe you should never become a physician or a dentist or whatever you're aiming to do. It's not good for you. So you think you're in a good place, but it turns out to be in a terrible place and you don't really know, which is to say that we human beings often can't plumb to the truth of our life situation. We think certain things are good when they're bad. We think certain things are bad when they turn out to be good. There is a tentativeness, I think, that we need to have as we reflect about our life situation. You think, you know, oh, you flunked that exam or you did really poorly, and how are you going to get into the grad school you want to get into? Maybe the best thing for you. Maybe you never should have gone to that graduate school. Why do you think you flunked? Because you're not good at it. So maybe choose another career that you're better at. In other words, you need to look at life in a very tentative way, never with total invested certainty. So I think that's a part of what I hear in this medrash. Okay, the story continues. skipping to where it's underlined. Perishu liyam, they departed to the sea. Amad aleim ruach sara miminam ubismolam. So a storm stood on either side of them, to the right and the left of the ship. But all the other ships that passed by were passing by in peace. You ever see this little cartoon of wherever this guy walks, there's always a storm over his head, whereas everybody is fine? So this is the ship. The ship is surrounded by this little cocoon of storm, you know, mimina musmolam. Everybody else is like, oh, beautiful day. This is great. Lovely sailing. So what I hear here in this way of putting it is that part of it is that, you know, sometimes you think your life is miserable and everybody else's life is good. You know, it isn't always quite that way. You know, it's so smooth sailing. I've got this big storm over my head. I'm depressed. I'm angry. I'm upset. My date didn't go well. Whatever. You know, you're upset about things. Everybody else, their life goes so smoothly and so easily. You know, it isn't always that way. But I think even more importantly, I think what the Medrash is teaching us, or what I hear in the Medrash, is that storms are often the products of our own choices. Yeah, it is easier for everybody else out there because they didn't do something dumb. So it is easier for them. I did something dumb. I made this choice, and this choice created an unnecessary storm that's hanging over my head. And it's true sometimes that there is this difference, and it's true, and this is a very something to think about in a Aseres Yemei Teshuva. Sometimes the challenges that we have in our lives are, the difficulties are self-imposed. We made bad choices, and those bad choices bring storms over our heads. But those choices could have been ruchnius and gashmius in many parts of our lives. But if you think about your life, you know, in the times you've had difficulties, sometimes you'll reflect that it was because you did something stupid. You should have done it. And it's a good thing not to do dumb things. So I hear in what the Medrash is teaching is this is a part of what, you know, he's got the storm over his head. Everybody else is cool because he did something dumb. Okay, so Reb Chanina over Mishivim Lashon Hayu Ba'aniyah V'Kolechad Aloha B'Yado Mishtachavim V'Omrim Nikro Isha Aloha. This, you know, this is the whole story with everybody says, you know, let's go through, serve our gods to prevent the storm. To the next line, Yona B'Tzara Snafsho Nirdam V'Yoaflo. But Yona went, as we know, to sleep. He was exhausted and he went to sleep. So, don't know exactly why he did this. Was this a further escaping from the kavo, the weight, the intensity of obligations, and one way to escape, as we all know, is to sleep. Sleep is the great escape from doing what you need to do, right? You need to study, you need to learn, you need to go to Seder, you need to daven, and what do? You sleep. Now, sometimes people are tired. But sometimes you sleep to avoid what life thrusts upon you. And it could very well be that this is just an extension of Yonah's escaping from the kavod. We've all felt this way on occasion in our lives. You know, this is like, there's so much to do. There's so many obligations. I got to get up for slichas, get up for davening, maybe go to Dr. Sokol's. I got to share morning Seder.
Joy.
What? That's a joy. Okay. Sameach Simcha Gedola. You know, so, and then morning Seder, and then I got to study, and I have an exam coming up. There's like so much to do. Maybe I'll just sleep. And so that's to escape. Sometimes a sleep is an escape. This might be also a harbinger of Yonah's suicidal tendencies, because he several times is mevakesh esnaf sholomus, and sleep is a bit like a kind of, you know, if you sleep a lot, if you people who are very depressed, as you know, sleep a lot. And that is escape. And that is also, I'm not going to say suicidal, because it's obviously a huge gap between suicide and sleep. But, you know, it's a micro reflection of suicide. You're just cutting off your life. I'll take your question in a second. It's, you're just like not engaging. You're just severing yourself from the things you have to do, and that is, just like Chazal say that dreams are 1/60th, Gemara and Brachas, dreams are 1/60th of Nevuah, so I would say excessive sleeping is 1/60th of death. If I can mirror Chazal. What?
The Gemara says that also.
Yeah, so the Gemara? Yeah, the Gemara says, huh? Maybe that's where I got it. It's not my invention. What?
Sangra?
Okay, thank you. I should know that. I taught that Gemara, but I guess I forgot. Okay.
I'm not sure how to read the
thank
words
you.
Here. What,
yeah.
What you're describing is kind of a more, you know, actively seeking sleep and actively seeking escape. But oftentimes, sleep is more of an inertial phenomenon where a person doesn't seek it out, but rather just does not... actively get up and do something.
Right, excellent. So I agree with that. That's another one of the thoughts I had in my notes here on the side.
Okay.
That it's a kind of like it's just he's accepting with resignation his fate. Like, okay, whatever it is, I'm just staying in bed and a storm will come. If I die, I die. It's like, as you say, it's just a kind of inertia. Just accepting passively your fate. You want to say something?
Don't we know besides Moshe Rabbeinu and Nevi'im would get Nevuah through sleep? So it says Yonah Betzor Snapshah, like, how do we know it's not his soul is in pain, so he went to sleep because maybe he would get Hashem would speak to him?
It's an interesting point. What's
he's
that?
Get Nebuah if he's sad.
I can't hear.
No, well, he won't get Nebuah if he's sad.
Right. Not sad, but he's in pain.
Well,
like,
he's also outside of Eretz Yisrael. Nebuah is only shown there. He's only shown Eretz Yisrael.
Okay.
Where it says that. I don't think, I mean, this is the overall flow of things. I don't think he was looking for Nebuah.
Like,
I think
it
says Vayah'af, he was exhausted.
Okay, fine.
I mean, how many of us are so tired that we just Vayah'af, we're exhausted with all the things, all the kaved, all the weight on top of us, near done, we just sleep. Yes?
Yeah, two things. To answer his question, to make another point.
Yeah.
The progression of the story seems to be that he's trying to avoid Nebuah, so probably wouldn't assume that he's trying to get Nebuah.
No, I'm saying right now it might seem like he's regretting. Like,
maybe he's doing tshuva.
He's starting to regret his decision.
I don't think so, though.
It's possible.
Once he sees no one else has a story.
If you look throughout the story, it seems that he's constantly trying to get away from me. Like, right. We know later he's actually willing to accept being thrown into the river. So, just another thing on the fact that he's actively looking for the sleep. The word that the Navi uses is nirdam, which is a very rare word, and the time that we have similar words in Bereshit is tardema, when God kind of like puts Adam in an induced coma, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly with Avraham and his Nebuah, they use that word too. So it seems like that's like an active, like, you know, you're like going to sleep as opposed to just falling asleep.
I would not agree. Nirdam is nifal. It's something that's transitive. It's happening to happen.
Yeah, but how would you differentiate that from like Shana?
I think it's a deeper sleep. He
yeah.
fell, falls into a, uh-huh. Look, it's a raging storm out
he
there.
To
he falls
melatonin.
Into a very, yeah.
I thought
he took Ambien.
I mean,
a little stronger than melatonin.
You compare it in a microcosmic way of suicide, so it could be it's a heavy sleep, meaning not just altruism.
Yeah.
It's like, get
yeah.
out of your sleep.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly correct. Okay, let's continue. I'm sorry for rushing the conversation a little bit, but this is a long, I got it, and I know you have to get to Morning Seder, so going a little faster than I usually do. Okay, so it continues. Rabbi Meir Omer, Memunya haya hadag livloa es yona misheshis yimei breshis. Shem memar vayaman Hashem dogodo. This fish was created in Sheshes Yimei Bereshis for the express purpose of swallowing Yonah thousands of years later. So the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos lists a number of things that were created, you know, during creation for later usage, like the Bilam's donkey and other things, Piyason. But question I ask myself is, what's the significance of this here? I mean, there are lots of things that could be created, Mishesha, why this in particular, so what does the Medrash want to teach us? So it occurs to me the following, that, remember, as the story unfolds, you'll see it even more dramatically. This is a very fantastical tale, and it's designed to give us Musar, to teach us something important about life. And and Yonah, in this sense, is a model for human beings, or a prototype of human beings who escape their obligations because it's too kavod for them, it's too kaved for them, it's too heavy for them. So he needs to go to a place where the kavod of Hashem is not. If you think of it in those terms, then you might say that from the very creation of the world, human beings were destined to avoid their destiny. Human beings were destined to escape the obligations of life. And to be a Jew, what is it to be a Jew more than maybe any other religion in the world? I mean, I'm not an expert in comparative religions, but certainly to be a Jew is fundamentally to be commanded. I mean, that's the air we breathe, the woof and warp of our lives is we are mitzuvim. From the moment we get up, you know, literally, you all wake your eyes, Netilas Yadayim, Moda Ani. There, not a moment goes by when obligations don't devolve upon you. Right? To learn, to daven, to Gemilas Chasadim. You know, there's always something that you need to be doing. That's what characterizes Jewish life. There's no space in your life which is free of obligations. Go on vacation. Well, you need to justify your vacation. You can't just stop and go on vacation. It's got to be for the right reasons, in the right way, doing the right thing. You can't just totally chill, right? You need to, even vacation, when you're leaving your usual routines, there are mitzvahs. You're on vacation, Zman Kriya Shema still beckons, you need to take a talis and fill with you. You need to learn every day, you have to learn something, you know, even though you're on vacation. You never fully escape the commanded life. And that is at the heart, to my mind, of Yiddishkeit, of you're always in Eved Hashem. In fact, I would say that the purpose of Torah and mitzvot in many ways is to cultivate within us a stance, a consciousness of being in Eved Hashem. Because how else are you going to get close to Hashem if not being in Eved? He's really great. And you're, who are you? Well, one way to get close to him is be an Eved of Hashem. You know, you're always doing what he wants, so you have a connection. You feel Shivisi Hashem L'negdi Tam, and you're always... Now, that is the brilliance of Judaism. Like, there's even an order in which you're supposed to cut your fingernails. Like, there's nothing. Like, what could be more innocuous than cutting your fingernails? Well, you know, there's a special order. If you look at the Shulchan Aruch, yeah, you know, there's an order to cut your fingernails. That seems excessive, but that's the point. The point is that there's nothing devoid of Hashem in your life. Nothing. Every aspect of your life is enriched by the consciousness of Hashem. But sometimes people feel they need to escape that weight of obligation, of constantly having to do something. Yonah is a metaphor, as well as in this medrash, for a person who escapes what to him makes no sense at that particular moment. It made no sense to go to Nineveh. It would be harmful to him, harmful to Bnei Yisrael. He wanted to escape the kavod. And what I think the medrash here may be saying is Hashem knew when he created the world that people sometimes would need to escape. Would try to escape because they would find the weight oppressive. Yonah is a, as I say, a metaphor for every human being who, in the course of his life, will sometimes feel like this is too much for me. And it's normal. It's okay to feel that way. You just need to cope with it in a productive way. But it's going to happen. Misheshish may bracious, there's going to be people going to feel this way, and there's going to be a dug that will be ready to swallow you up and deal with you. And we have to figure out what that means, and then we're going to see that in just a second. So I think that's the way I read this. Maybe there are definitely other ways to read it, but that's the way I read it. Let's continue. Nichnas l'soch piv ka'adam shenichnas l'beis ha'kneses gedola. He goes into the mouth of a dog as if he's going into a giant shul. Would you have chosen that as a metaphor for the mouth of a fish? A giant shul? What's with the giant shul? So I actually was discussing this with Rabbi Bamberger, and he mentioned to me a pshat that I think that he heard, which is that a shul is a place you escape to. It's a sanctuary from the turbulence and travails of life. Life's tough, life's crazy, work hard, a lot of stuff going on, go to shul. And I think that's a beautiful reading of this. But the problem with this, not that it's a bad reading, I think it's a good reading, is what does Yonah not do in the dug of the fish, in the fish? He davens. He doesn't daven. Remember? He doesn't daven. And in fact, the Agadah to the Medrash makes it even clearer later. He doesn't daven. Days go by and he doesn't daven. He's going into shul.
Socialize.
But he doesn't daven. Like the Kiddush.
Yeah, exactly.
Like gefilte fish. Gefilte fish.
Like when they say in Kaddish at the end, you know?
What's that?
Eating gefilte fish
and so it is the case that people go to shul for sanctuary but don't daven. We all know that. People go to shul. Even people come, you know, on time. Even people who say the tefillos, are they always davening? You know, you could mumble the words and not really daven. So, you know, you have this, it's a brilliant irony. He goes into the mouth of the fish as a sanctuary to escape, but he can't bring himself to daven. There's a very famous story by Agnon. Anybody here ever read Agnon? It pains me not to see any hands up.
It's Agnon.
You should... You ever hear of Agnon? Wow. Shai Agnon. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He wrote in Hebrew. very interesting man, very interesting rant, brilliant writer, religious man, by the way. Was he? You know, the ceremony famously was, to get the Nobel Prize, he took his Gemara with him. He wore a big yarmulke, I think, was on Shabbos, and he asked for a postponement. I mean, I don't mean your little yarmulkes. I mean like a big yarmulke type. A very interesting man. I don't get it. But anyway, he talks about this. One of the stories about Yom Kippur, actually, now that I think about it, it's about Yom Kippur. He describes this person who keeps on, wakes up, got to go to shul for Yom Kippur, has to do this. He never makes it to shul on Yom Kippur. Keeps on trying to get, oh, I got to get there again. And he goes up in the room, oh, it's Neil, I better get shul. And he somehow never makes it to shul on Yom Kippur, which is obviously a metaphor for somebody who's struggling with his desire to go to shul and his yearning to go to shul, but his ambivalence about going to shul. And Agdon, for a period of time, was not religious. He was raised religious, a town called Butsatz in Galicia. And then for a short period of time, he left it, and then he came back to it, and he was very learned. He wrote a book, actually, called Yamim Noraim, which was, he was very fond of Yamim Noraim. And he wrote a collection, I actually have it at home in English translation. I have many of his works in Hebrew too, but I happen to have this in English translation. It's a collection of many, many Mamari Chazal and Hasidish and Vertlach and all kinds of things on the Yom Naran. He was a really very erudite, Jewishly. And what's so wonderful about his writing is, this is an aside and I really don't have time for this, but what's so wonderful about his writing is that it is the language of, it's rabbinic language, and it's woven, his literary writing is woven with allusions to Medrash and Chazal and Psukim from all over Tanakh. It's like, it's an amazing thing. That's why when you see it in translation, you miss it, because you don't catch, if you've learned, you'll hear in the Hebrew allusions to, oh, I remember that, oh, that's it. But of course in English, you lose that. Anyway, so I just mentioned this because here's somebody who's struggling to get to shul and doesn't quite make it to shul. So Yonah is in the dog like a base Knesset, but he's not at the moment a davener, and we need to, key question, why doesn't he daven? That's really one of the key questions about Yonah. Why doesn't he daven? I mean, he's Bitzaras Nafsha, right? That's the way the Medrash describes it. Like, what does it take him days to daven? The most natural thing for any from Jew, you're in trouble, you daven. He's a Navi, right? So what does it take him 3 days to daven? So that's really a crucial question. And in effect, we will see an answer to that question proposed by this Medrash as I read it. Okay, so let's continue. The two eyes of the fish were like windows. Amar pensaos meiros liyona. They were like lights that lit up for Yonah. Remeir Omer, magolius haisa tuluya b'meyev sheldag, u'meira liyona k'shemesh hazeh. There was a diamond hanging inside the intestine of the dog, and it lit up for Yonah like the sun. Sheheir Bigvura, which lights up with power. Vera'a Yona kol ma shebiyamim uvitahomos. Yona saw everything that was in the sea and in the depths of the sea. What? Yeah, a little like it's so hard, right. Now, this is very significant, and we'll see the significance a little bit later. So I'm going to read a chunk of lines and then come back and analyze this. Okay, you can't really see the significance of this light and of seeing the yamim and the seeing everything until the story unfolds. So let's continue reading, and then we'll go back and analyze. Amalei hadag li Yonah. The dog says to Yonah. So this is a conversation between Doug and, which is why and Yonah, this is like, suggests to me that this is a little fantastical, that it wasn't necessarily literal. I mean, it happens, we know, in the Torah says there was a conversation between an Ason and Bilam, but that's pretty irregular, and that's the Torah. So this is, quite a story as it unfolds, you'll see. Iyata yodea shiomi bolis achel etok piv sholvat levyasen. Don't you know that today is my day to be eaten by the levyasen? You picked a bad motel. Not a good place to be. It's like, I'm going to go down to take a vacation in Florida right before Hurricane Irma. Not a good plan. Like, you picked a bad place. Amar lo, he said to him, Holi cheni etzlo, take me to him. Vani matzil oso mit the oscha mipiv. Vani matzil osiva oscha mipiv. Take me to him, and I'll save both of us from his yawning mouth. Halicho etzel Levyasan. He took him to the Levyasan. And Yonah says to Levyasan, Amarlo bishvilcha yoradati liros es madurcha bayam. I went down because of you to see where you live in the sea. Is that true?
No.
Seems not to be true. Why did Yonah go to the sea? To escape. Is he telling a fib? So we need to, let's read some more and I'll try to answer that question. The Medrash doesn't explicitly answer it, but I think it suggests an answer. V'lo od, and not only that, Shani asid leireid v'litein chaval barosh, I'm going to go down and put a rope around your neck, v'la'asos tsu'uda b'mechal tzadikim, and to make a su'uda from you for the tzadikim. What is this an allusion to? Who remembers?
Olam Haba.
Exactly, Olam Haba. Levyasan will be served to the tzadikim li'asid lava. And next, he does something quite shocking in a way. Heruhu chosamo shel Avraham Avinu. He showed him his bris milah. Hibrit libris. He looked at the bris for Ra Levyasan. The Levyasan saw Yonah's bris milah. Ubarach milfanav mahalech shnei yamim. He escaped 2 days away. He was so frightened, he raced away a 2 day distance from this. Like, what does that mean? What does this mean? I know you think it's interesting, and I see the smiles, but I think there's obviously something deep here, right? And what I think, before I explain it, let me continue. But this is very interesting. Heruhu. Okay, so Amar lo. So now Yonah says to the dog that's housing him, Ani hitzalticha mipiv shel Levyasan. I've saved you from the mouth of the Levyasan. Har'eini kol ma shebeyamim v'tahomos. This is what he said before. It was lit up like he could see all the seas and the depths. Now I want you to show me everything in the seas and the depths of the earth. So now he goes on this extraordinary odyssey. And I choose the word odyssey with care. What is the odyssey about?
Greek,
he traveled through the sea. Yes, a Greek. Yeah.
Homer, what is it?
Odysseus travels through the sea. So it's the name of Homer's works. So what did he see? What's this odyssey that he took? Nachal Godol Shel Okinos, the great river. And by the way, I don't have time to read all of it, but what he shows him is all based on Yonah's tefillah. And say for Yoni, look at the tefillah, and these are midrashes of each of the phrases in the tefillah, which I'm not going to go into right now. But here's, we'll quickly go through the journey. The great sea which feeds the Okinos. Okinos is, what language is that?
Greek.
It's Greek, from Okeanos. Okeanos is the Greek word for, it's actually the name of a god, but also ocean. Our English word ocean comes from, we soften the sea, we make it sea, not ka. But Okeanos is a Greek word. So he showed him the great river which fed the ocean. There, Shvile Yamsuf, showed them the actual path that the Jews went through when they went through the Yamsuf. Now, Heruhu Makom Shemishpere Hayam Elav Yotze. Did you ever wonder where waves come from?
From the moon?
Well, where did the first wave come from? So, I mean, whatever physicists would explain, however they would answer that, there was a belief in ancient times that there was a place from the earth where all the waves came out. So waves are a very prominent part of the experience of the ocean. So he showed him where the waves emanated from, the origin of waves. Heru emude Eretz b'mecho now. He showed them the pillars that held up the foundations of the earth. Heru Sheol Tachtis. He showed him the Sheol. Sheol is the underworld where the Tanakh says souls go after death. They go to Sheol. So he showed them the underworld where souls go after death. Heru Gehenim. Showed him Gehenim. Haro Heichal Hashem, he showed him the palace of Hashem, whatever that means. And he saw there the rock, which is the foundation, which holds up all the depths. It was, this, they believe, this deep foundational rock, which holds up all the tahomos, all the deep depths of the world. And he saw the Bnei Korach standing, if it, by allusion to a chazal, and davening there. And of course, now we pick up with Yonah not davening. He saw it. So what do you hear in this journey? So what? Here is what I understood. This is my explanation. Maybe you'll have a different explanation. That's fine, but this is the way I read it. Remember he told, Yonah told the Leviathan, I came here to see where you live. I said, is that not a fib? Well, maybe not. Maybe it's true. Because one way to understand Yonah's escape is to escape from religious obligation, in his case, obeying the tzivui to deliver this nevuah, to the enchantment and intoxication of exploring the world, of intellectual freedom, of being liberated to go to the depths and see the what causes the waves to go. Where do waves come from? What holds up the earth? How do we make sense of the world we find ourselves in? And I would suggest to you that one way to understand this is that Yonah embarked on to leave the Kavod Hashem, what's for him, to be liberated, to explore the world. I'll take him at his words. I went to check out where you are, Leviathan. I went to encounter the mysteries of the universe. And the universe is an extraordinarily fascinating place. And Yonah, you might say, became intoxicated with the wonder of intellectual inquiry, of understanding, you know, how the DNA is actually constructed, of studying the Krebs cycle, of, I don't know, understanding antimatter, matter, neutrinos, gravity, the four basic forces of the world, weak force, a strong force, the electromagnetic force. It's to, wow, it's the natural world is extraordinary. It's enchanting. It's amazing. And Yonah leaves the kavod, the weight of obligation, to be liberated in the sea where everybody floats, right? You know, you don't, you float. And you go out. Like I felt when I take my kayak into the ocean. You just, there's a sense of wonder at the extraordinary vastness of the world, which now Yonah on this odyssey is capable of embarking on. That's the meaning of the lights. He became, quote, enlightened. Now, I don't mean to say that he didn't put on talis and tefillin and he didn't keep the Torah mitzvot. So I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that he felt driven by virtue of the irrational command placed upon his neck, which he took to be irrational, to bring Nineveh to tshuva. He felt compelled to just, I can't, this is irrational, it doesn't make sense. I'm going to go out and explore the world. I'm going to go see where the Leviathan lives. I want to look at the world from a different place, where I'm not constantly oppressed by obligations that I don't really understand. Now, that's his first experience. He goes, he sees the light. Then he goes to the Leviathan, and the Leviathan is a trope, is a metaphor for the powerful forces of nature. There is no beast in the world more powerful than Leviathan. That's to encounter the brute force of nature. It's Hurricane Irma, is to encounter the brute force, the earthquake in Mexico, is to encounter the brute force of the natural world, the enchantment, the wonder at that brute force, and what Yonah does to vanquish it is to show him his bris milah, which is to say to the Leviathan, and the Leviathan heard this, that the natural world is not a sufficient, the wonders of the natural world aren't sufficient to answer one profound question. Why? Why is there a Leviosa? Why are there Tahomos? Why are there waves? I know where the waves come from. But what is the meaning and the significance of that? What does it do for my life? How do I explain that there is a natural world at all and that there are these grand forces of nature driving me, like the Leviosa? How do I explain what it means? The natural world in itself is inert. It has no meaning. What Yonah showed the Leviathan is his bris milah, which is a symbol of our sacrifice of ourselves to Hashem. What could be more sacrificial than a doting mommy and daddy giving their little 8-day-old baby boy to a knife to cut up? That's to say that ultimate meaning in life doesn't come from the wonders of the natural world. They're great, but why are they there? What's the meaning of it? Ultimate significance of life comes only when you can show your bris milah, when you can live a life that has meaning by sacrificing yourself to Hashem, which transcends the natural world. You see, a life devoid of mitzvos is ultimately, okay, waves, all right, nice, fun, I like kayaking. But what's the point of it? Like, what's the point of my life? Why am I alive? Natural world can't answer that question. The natural world can be intellectually exhilarating to explore, but it can never answer the deepest questions about life, which is, why am I here? And the only ultimate answer to that question for Yonah is the bris milah, to sacrifice himself, to be an eved Hashem, and to live a commanded life. To live a commanded life, a life confronting you with the sometimes inexplicable will of Hashem, and to submit to that will is what raises you above the inert, inexplicable natural world. Let me just finish, and then I'll be happy to take your question. Now, that's what Yonah told the Leviathan. The Leviathan heard, but Yonah himself didn't hear. He says what he has to say, but he obviously hasn't internalized the message. Because what does he do right after the Leviathan runs away? He goes back to these and says, I want to explore some more. Which is to say, you can verbalize, hey, mitzvahs are great. But how deeply do you internalize those mitzvahs? That understanding that life has no significance but for its transcendence. Life has no significance but for its ultimate transcendence. You can say, oh, I like mitzvahs, it's great, I'll submit what I need, do everything. Have you really, really, really internalized and submitted yourself to Hashem as an Eved Hashem, as the only means of answering the most disturbing question that you as a human being will be faced with, which is, why? What's the point of it? What's the meaning of it? What am I here for? The natural world can never answer that. In principle, it can. It can never answer how it got here. The Big Bang, science starts with the Big Bang. Scientists can, in principle, never explain why there was a Big Bang. They can't go before the Big Bang, because the laws of science are the world. But they can never answer the question, why is there a world? Because that's not what science does. Science takes data and explains them. Makes observations, develops hypotheses, and conducts experiments to test hypotheses. That's what science does. Starts with data. Why is there data? Why is there any data? Science can't answer that question. Only religion can answer that question. And that's Yonah's insight, but it takes him a while to get there. Knows the formula, like many of us. We know the formula. We know the routine. We know what to say. But we haven't fully internalize it, and Yonah is still intoxicated with his journey around the world. Okay, very briefly, a very quick question.
Well, I was going to ask why he still goes, the fish and take him across the world. You say you didn't internalize it.
Oh, yes, that was my
answer. Didn't he hear the vision of him from the light in the fish? And then the fish, he
Yeah, but it's not one thing to have a nice flashlight, you know, but it doesn't mean you can actually see 7,000 miles away. I mean, he took him on this grand journey of the universe. So. He didn't take that incredibly long journey. He just had a flat light, you know, it was light, so he could see, but the journey brought it to life. Okay, let's continue.
So it's a myth that it's a whale. That's the...
It has the dog. It doesn't
right,
say whale.
It's Jonah and the whale.
Yeah, I know, right. Okay, I know it's late, so we have to finish. So let's try to finish. Okay. So he sees the B'nai Korach davening. It wasn't davening. So why wasn't he davening? Didn't daven. Because he was too intoxicated with the wonders of the world. So, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ani hirchavti lo makom b'mei hadag zachar. I dumped him in a male fish. Kadesh lo yitztayer. So that it should be easier for him. Ruenu mispalo. Ani mezamein daga meuberes. Let him go into a female fish who is pregnant. Pregnant with shasa alafim revavos dagim. 365,000, whatever it is. What's the, how would you term? 3,650,000, what would it be? 3 billion? Okay, we have a mathematician here, so that's good. 365 billion. Obviously, the number is significant. Kadeshi yistar v'yispal l'fanai, so that he has sar and that he davened before me. There's a Kadosh Baruch Hu likes its tefillah of tzaddikim. So the medrash I'm skipping describes this encounter with the dog and this female fish threatens to swallow the male fish unless he spits up Yonah. He spits up Yonah, she swallows him. Yonah is obviously pretty uncomfortable, and he davens as a result of all this tsar. What causes Yonah to escape from the intoxicating power of intellectual inquiry and science? No?
Uncomfortability.
Tvilas, yes. Tsar. Yisurin. Pain. Pain causes people that yisurim shake people's complacency. You know, all of the kind of philosophy that he may have studied, I know, like he told Levyasan, he showed him the bris, you know, he showed him his bris. That wasn't enough. He had to feel pain. He had to feel that it was being crushed. And it's the world of nature which had intoxicated him, which becomes the vehicle for his redemption. Because what crushes him? The world of nature. It's so it's the very science which had enticed him, now turns against him, that natural world, and crushes him in the... Now, what's the significance of fish? And what's the significance of this number? Fish of the future. I mean, baby fish. The eggs are the future. 365 billion days of the year. What Yonah came to realize being crushed in this fish was that the eternal future of the world, right? All of these, there is no future without a Kadosh Baruch Hu. There is no future. You know, he was crushed and he realized that nature is not meaningful in the future. He was crushed, so to speak, by the empty future of a world devoid of mitzvos, a world devoid of the obligation to be an Eved Hashem. There is no sufficiency to the natural world. It will crush you. The natural world itself will crush you by its future. Okay, so he davens to Hashem, which I'm not going to read for you right now, but... He davens. Let's go on to the next page. Go to where I started underlying. Lo nene. Hashem doesn't answer. Atse yatsa davez emipim. Hashem answers its tefillah only when he says this. Asher nadarti lahalos es levyasan v'lasoso lefnehem. Ashalem b'yom Yeshuas Yisrael v'ani b'kol Torah ez b'chalach. The Medrash darshens, that he vows, as the Medrash understands it, to slaughter the Leviosa. Davening isn't enough. You have to destroy the source of your temptation. You need to promise that you will slaughter the natural world which had so enchanted you with its majesty and mystery to return to a life of kaved, of the kavod Hashem. He had a davening wasn't enough. He had to commit himself to take action. You can daven, that's lovely. But you've got to do something. You know, we're coming to the davening of Yom Kippur. You can daven. You need to make commitments. And here, he had to make a commitment to slaughter the very vehicle of his enchantment and enlightenment with the natural world. He had to slaughter it. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu answers his tefillah. He's saved. And finally, and with this I'll conclude, V'ro hamalachim, the sailors see what happened. This is told in Sefer Yonah. And they go and they give up their gods. And it says they bring sacrifices, karbanos. What does the Medrash say? Look at the last line. Ela hizevach zavcho, ela bris mila, shukadama zevach. The sailors circumcised themselves. The sailors came to internalize the message that Yonah had superficially sent to the Leviathan. Life has meaning only if you live a commanded life, full of mitzvahs, full of halachos. They are what gives meaning and significance to a life that is otherwise as inert as the natural world is, of value, of meaning, of significance, of transcendence. And I will conclude by asking you the following question. If this is an allegory, which I've suggested that it is, what is the allegorical reference? What are the malachim an allegorical reference to? Who would the malachim be? And I think the answer to that question is you and I. The malachim saw what happened to Yonah. We, the readers of this medrash, saw what the Medrash depicts about the rebellion against the commanded life, a life of intellectual inquiry and pursuit as freedom, the limitations of that life, the serious limitations of that life, the dangers of that life. And we, like the Malachim, must do the very same tshuva that they did, which is that we need to internalize that message. We need to circumcise ourselves. We are all males in this room circumcised, but we need to recircumcise ourselves, which is to say, we need to once was enough, I know, but we need to but we need to recommit. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, that's very, very good, Mandy. We need to circumcise our hearts. We need to remember, you know, you're all in college, you're studying sciences, or, you know, psychology, whatever, the economics, whatever you're studying. It's very exciting, intellectual inquiry. It can be very liberating. And it's a good thing. But it has no ultimate value. The ultimate value comes from being an Eved Hashem, of circumcising yourself, of living a life of mitzvos. That is the only life that can take you above and transcend the limits of intellectual inquiry, the limits of the natural world. That is the bris milah that the sailors underwent. And I think, we read this on Yom Kippur, that's the bris milah, mal Hashem es levavcha, as Mendy says, that we need to undergo in Yom Kippur. We need to understand that you can never escape the kavod Hashem. And the mitzvos are not to be escaped, but the mitzvos are the ultimate answer to the question of what gives your life and my life meaning.